You're listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. Interesting conversations about innovation, economics, culture, and history for the independent thinkers and curious minds. I'm your host, Alex Wolf.
What up? Hi, thank you for tuning in to this episode. And today we are talking about money versus wealth. What's the difference? We use the terms very interchangeably, and I think it could benefit us to see how they are not the same. They're definitely related, but understanding how they aren't the same, I think, can really help our relationship with money if we have a stressful one, which I know many of us do. I think it can also help us feel wealthy when we understand the difference between money and wealth, because as I usually talk about in the United States and Western culture, there's so much pressure to be a bajillionaire. There's so much pressure to be extremely rich. And when you don't really understand what wealth is, you might not feel wealthy even if you are. So that's what we're going to be talking about. And hopefully at the end of this episode, you'll realize just how much wealth you have and how much you might have more wealth than a billionaire. We'll see if we can make that make sense. So I think that I'm happy I brought up the tech reification in a previous episode. I brought it up in the episode about understanding time and redefining our understanding of time. And tech reification, if you didn't hear that previous episode, is basically mistaking the map for the territory. So it's when we confuse a technology, an invention, or even an ideology with the actual substance. So the term that's the easiest to comprehend that is don't mistake the map for the territory. Maps are not territory. They just show the territory. But oftentimes in tech, we forget what the actual reality of something is, and we confuse it with whatever invention we're using to measure it or map it out, navigate it, right? And this causes so much confusion and pain, and it really happens a lot with time. That's why I wanted to do the episode about time, but it happens just as much with money. So, money started being used over 100,000 years ago, and it's funny because it's a type of currency, right? It's a medium of exchange, and it is the heart of the way most modern societies operate. And it's also just, I think we need to realize how old and kind of natural it is. One of my goals about talking about tech philosophy is showing how natural it is for human beings to invent, and how the narrative of tech being these like artificial, you know, separate from man sort of trinkets or inventions in some ways can't always be applied, because you talk about early civilization and techniques used in farming and tools and inventions used literally shaped our brains, meaning that it was when we figured out how to create, you know, controlled fires that we started cooking food, and then that cooked food literally has changed the shape of our brains. It's shaped changed the shape of our teeth and things like that. So technology to me is, it's not a separate thing. It's almost like it's a relationship between us and the earth. So that's why I think it's so beautiful, right? And so when we talk about money, money is one of those things. Money goes up there with spears and you know, caves and all those things. It's really old. And before we had money, we were using what was called sort of like gift economics or trade economics, which was basically trying to negotiate what resources you had and trade it with other people's resources. So maybe you had a bunch of corn and your neighbor had a bunch of cattle, and you know, if you both felt it was fair, you would trade it. But clearly you can see how this might be difficult because, say, you have a bunch of corn, but you want a bunch of cabbage, and the cabbage guy doesn't want the corn. What do you do? And so money was meant to be this, like, universal unit of exchange so that the cabbage guy doesn't need your corn. He can take your money and then use that money to spend on whatever the hell he wants. And so it's a beautiful, beautiful invention. And I think it's so beautiful because I see how economic it is, if that makes sense. And I'll be breaking down how I see economics versus finances. But it was really about how do we maximize our ability to trade in a way that's fair, in a way that's aligned with our best interests as individuals. And, you know, just some brief history of money. Shekels, you know, was one of the first early examples of money used in Mesopotamia in 3000 BC to measure a specific mass of barley, you know, in Asia, Africa, Australia, and the Americas, we use shells as tender. And it was Lydian who first introduced gold and silver as coinage in 600 BC. And I bring that up because it's important to note that the actual physical object being used to trade didn't matter as much as just the trust the community had in trading it. So the actual coinage or whatever you were using, the shell, it didn't have to have a physical value, but it had to have an intangible value, right? And it's very similar to how we use money today, because our money obviously used to be backed by the gold standard, which meant that each one of your dollars represented a amount of gold you could trade in. And then in 71, that standard was removed. And so all of our money is fiat currency, which means that it's government controlled and regulated. And so what holds the dollar together is just our trust, right? It's like the one thing we do trust, because we don't trust each other. But the point is that back in the day when people were using the shells and the shekels and all those things, the physical quantities of these monies were not practical because people just started having like piles of shells in their house. And that's what kind of inspired banks to happen, and coins and stuff like that, gold coins and stuff like that. So banks were made to store these quantities, and the banks would issue bank notes as a receipt to say, hey, you know, we have your, you know, 10,000 shells or your 10,000 coins. And if you ever need it, you take this banknote and you can come here and take it out. But then this is such a great example of tech reification, because what happened is people would take those banknotes, and since the banks were trusted and everybody had those banknotes, people just started trading the banknotes. So before, people were trading the actual coins or the shells. But then, you know, the cabbage guy would be like, hey, is that a banknote? Okay, how much is it worth? Okay, yeah, I'll just hold on to that. And if I need to go get those coins, I'll just go to the bank. But what happened is people were not going to the bank. It's such a, like, this story is so amazing, because the fact that this is even how shit went down and the reason why we're here where we are now is just amazing to me. So so of course the bank is like hype. The bank is like, oh shit, like, we're just holding this money and they're not, you know, coming back for it. And what banks are really good at, banks are really great at tech, enforcing tech reification, meaning they're really good at making people mistake the map for the territory, because they're all about manipulating the abstract part of money, which I'll be breaking down in a more tangible way. But I say that to say that they started to think about creative ways to profit off of the money that was in the banks through lending. And so it's just this like crazy situation where, I say crazy, but at the same time, it's also just very, as humans, we are liable to this type of tech reunification. So, and the banknote originated in the Chinese Song Dynasty, of course, and did not reach Europe until around like 1661. And banknotes are what your paper money are. That's kind of like, they are like the fossil. Or, yeah, banknotes are like the fossil of what we have now, because if you look at your physical money, it will say, you know, this is a Federal Reserve note, and it is meant to represent a standard of value that I, like I mentioned before, is not no longer the gold standard, but is now just kind of, it's not really backed by a standard. It's backed by, again, our trust, which, you know, luckily has been enough for now. There's definitely a lot of, you know, different opinions about what's going to happen to the dollar and blah, 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 which we can talk about that another time. But what's even crazier is that most of our money today is not even paper. It is pixels. I believe 97% of our money is digital. So we don't even have the paper tender that is a receipt of gold that doesn't exist. We have pixels that, you know, people type in with a keyboard, and that's what's running the world, which is creepy when you think about it, but here we are, right? So that is money, okay? That is money. And one of my favorite little stories from Alan Watts is he talks about, you know, a person going to the grocery store and the cashier saying, you know, that'll be $50, please. And he talks about how the customer makes a little frown because they have to trade that legal tender for, you know, perhaps some peaches and lettuce and milk. And Alan Watts kind of makes a joke, and he goes, "For why are you frowning? You are trading this practically worthless piece of tech, right? And you're getting peaches. You're getting the actual wealth. Boom." So when we're talking about wealth, right, what he was saying in the story is that groceries are the real miracle in the transaction. The money is nothing you should feel sad to part with, because you can't eat it, but you can eat a peach, you can eat lettuce, blah, blah, blah. And money is the map, and wealth is the territory, okay? Money is the map. It's helpful. It helps us map things. It helps us navigate things. It helps us measure things. But it is not the thing. Wealth is the thing. And, you know, it's kind of like we go to a restaurant and we're more obsessed with the menu than the food itself. We're more obsessed with, like, oh, you know, you might as well take your fork and knife and try to cut the menu up and eat that. If you are so obsessed with money and you think money is wealth, money is not the wealth. Wealth is the territory, okay? It is the actual thing. It is the peach, the plum, the apple, the, I'll share the definition a little bit more deeply, but I say that to say that we often talk about how Americans, Western people, blah, 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 are materialistic. All we care about is things. And in a way, that's true. But when you really think about it literally, that's not true. We're actually more of abstractionists than we are materialists. What I mean is that a materialist is someone who really loves material, who really can appreciate the fibers in plants and the texture of certain fabrics, who can, you know, really savor the pigment in a fruit, or the texture of, you know, I don't know, a flower, right? Materialists love and have a very sensory based appreciation for material things. Sure, Americans and Westerners like accumulating shit. We like having a bunch of physical shit to measure like our success or whatever. But the way we actually manufacture these things, we don't give a shit about them. Okay? Best example is fashion. Real shirts and real pants, when I say real, I mean good quality, right? They are made with good quality material, which means that it has to come out of the earth somehow. Okay, so that means someone has to farm it. Then someone has to weave those materials into a good quality fabric. Okay, this is labor. Good labor costs money. Okay, so we haven't even made the pants yet. Just getting the fabric, someone waking up at the crack of dawn to feed the certain crops or whatever, or, you know, and I'm talking about organic fabrics. Obviously, there's synthetic ones, but we're talking good quality, right? There's some good quality synthetic fabrics that we've been able to invent, which is amazing, but we're talking about like just like farm to closet, right? So the pants aren't even made yet, and you've had to hire two different types of experts who are only going to work at a certain price to get that type of quality in the actual crop and then in the actual fabric. Then you have to pay a seamstress or someone who can sew the pants together, and that is also a high-skill job. And if you want a good job, you're going to also have to pay that person. So a good pair of pants should cost around, like maybe you'd get a good deal around like, I want to say between like 150 to like 250. That's how much a good pair of pants would cost if you appropriately laid out like the economics of it, right? The wealth of it. The fact that, okay, to get this crop, to get this fabric, you know, we need skilled experts, blah, 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 blah. But what happened is with the Industrial Revolution and with toxic tech philosophy, we were really focused on how to make mass amounts of the same product. And we were willing to cheapen each step of that process to create those pants. And so we have a lot of what we consider to be good pants. I'm not going to say good quality, but we do think we have a lot of good pants because they will fit and they will look good for like a couple, I was going to say months, but honestly, I'm going to say weeks. Okay. They'll look good for a couple weeks, but what's going to happen? What makes them not be valuable in a few weeks? Well, first of all, they're probably made out of shitty material, so something might break, something might tear. Secondly, you have to deal with the fashion world, which is telling you the pants don't look good anymore. So that completely, like, you know, abstract pressure of like, oh, these pants are out of style, okay? And so, yeah, and then I was going to say, too, the way, so the fabric is cheap, but also the way it was made. So maybe a seam will become undone, a button will pop. And basically, you have a piece of shit. You have a piece of crap in your closet. And if you have gone through your fast fashion phase, like many of us have, like where basically you go through your closet and you realize, like, all the clothes that you have used to be vibrant and used to hold shape, and now they're like dingy and gross and they're not the same clothes they used to be. It's because they were made cheaply. But what happens is the everyday consumer thinks pants should be cheap. And then you'll hear on Twitter like, I ain't paying that. Da-da-da-da-da. I'm not paying for da-da-da-da because I should be able to just pay this. Well, things have to grow out of the ground. I think that's always been my main thing about, like, when people are like, oh, things should be cheap. Yeah, I think to a certain extent, that is fair. But what it does, when too many things are cheap, it creates this false illusion that things aren't as expensive, or I don't want to say expensive, but they aren't the price that they actually are. So I say all of that about being a materialist, because a materialist is totally okay with paying the farmer and then paying the person to make the fabric and then paying the seamstress and then wearing those pants and having those pants forever. And you see these values in some, not all, don't freak out before the fashion people go down my throat. You see those values played out in some European fashion houses, not so much anymore, which if we want to have a whole episode about that, we can. But, you know, there's a whole stereotype of how Italians like quality clothes, and they are materialists because they are more willing to pay $250, $150 for a pair of pants that will last, you know, years, than the American, you know, generally speaking, who wants to pay $50 and wear the pants for whatever, a few weeks, a few months. That is what I mean when I say that we are not materialists and we are more abstractionists. We are more focused not on the physical material of things, but on the ideological expression or the abstract expression of the material. We don't really love the fabric. We might think we do, but if you're falling for, oh, I'm going to get this because it looks good and it's cheaper right now, and without knowing it's going to fall apart, then you're buying it for an ideological purpose. You're buying it with prioritizing an ideology that pants should be like this, and, you know, I should have these pants for this occasion. You're not even thinking about, like, long term. Like, that whole notion got kind of pushed out of fashion because fashion needs you to change your mind about what to wear. Now, I'm not taking a hit at fashion. I love fashion, and I think that a lot of designers got unfairly put in this position because basically the designers who really care, the Yves Saint Laurents of the world, the Diors of the world, and I'm talking about the actual designers, not the brands, they want to create you an immaculate $23,000 dress that's worth that because everything's been hand-stitched, every sequin has been fucking lifted up to the sun, and, you know, that is their art. That is how this shit started. But, you know, the abstractionist idea, the mass production idea was like, oh, we don't care about that. And if you read Dior's autobiography, it's in my Amazon bookstore, he even says that, you know, I noticed the American woman would rather have five cheap dresses than one good one, and the French woman wants one good one. So I'm not saying one is better than the other. I'm saying that materialists would rather have one good one, and abstractionists would rather have, like, five cheaper ones. And to call Americans materialists, we're not. Look at our food. Most of the food is shitty. Like, most of the food, we're growing, like, crappy food. You can't really care about material and grow, like, shitty tomatoes and crappy food. All right. So what is this main difference between money and wealth? Because the Western society, United States, whatever, I don't want to only pick on Americans. I know I have a global audience and people are listening from all over. But we are very money obsessed. We could really give a fuck about wealth. We say wealth, but we don't know what that means. Just like we say it's a phone, but it's a computer. So wealth is finite and natural. I will repeat. Wealth is finite and natural. It is the strawberry. It is the cotton that's growing out of the ground. It is Water. It is your health. Health is wealth. Oh, yeah. That's not just a cliche. It is shit you can't, it's literally shit like you can't just buy. You can maybe like buy people, the service, like you can buy like having people make the thing, but it is the fruit of the earth, literally and figuratively. It is finite and natural. It is, it is health, it is food, it is any physical object around you that is made with that quality that I was talking about. Money is infinite, technically, especially today's money, because it's not backed by anything, so we can just print as much of it as we want. And money is not natural in the sense that it grows out of the ground. It's man-made. So that's the difference. Wealth is finite and natural. Money is infinite and man-made. We live in a culture that loves money. And we love money so much, we cannot value wealth. And sometimes people close their ears when they hear the word economics, or when I tell people, oh, I like economics, because they picture, what do they picture, guys? They picture a screen with stocks and lines and charts and, you know, mathematical, you know, calculations of the values of companies. That's not economics, that's finances, okay? It's a part of economics for sure, but it is the abstractionist part. It is the matrix. If you've listened to my other episode, I've talked about matrix. People hear matrix and they think I'm talking about the movie. No, I'm talking about the literal definition of a mathematical net put on top of something to measure it. I'm not really, like, finance is cool. You could put on the financial news. I'll watch, you know, I pay attention to some stocks. I have money in the market. But I'm not like, ooh, Google Gaga passionate. I think the people who are dope. But what I'm passionate about is economics. And that's not about the abstractionist part of it. It is about the wealth. I care more about, like, damn, who grew this? Where did this come from? When did this get shipped here? Is this local? You know, who was involved? How is the price like this? You know, economics is about wealth. And this is why I get a little sad when I see so many artists who shut their ears off when I talk about economics, because they think I'm talking about, you know, complicated charts. And I'm talking about what I know artists care about, which is resources, not money. Again, we have to really, I look at words for, in a deeper way. I don't mean to say that like, oh, I can see deeper, but I'm just saying that our definitions are all mixed up. So we hear resources and what do you think? Money. But resources are corn and cabbage and oil and water and air, which we are polluting. Air, which we now have to cover our faces when we go outside because of the situation we're in. Okay? That is wealth. Wealth is being able to walk outside without a mask and feel like you are not putting yourself in danger. That's wealth. Okay? We're not there yet right now because we've been so focused on money. We're just too blind to the wealth. So, yeah, I'm more into economics more because the trade of those physical things and even intangible value fascinate me more than finances. Finances are dope. It's just I like to make that distinction because I think a lot of people are into economics, but they don't know it because the definitions have been swashed all around and people mistake the map for the territory. I don't know anyone who loves Earth and all of the things that it bears, all the fruit that it bears. And again, when I say fruit, I mean literally and figuratively, so not just the fruit, but like anything, the glass, the minerals, the rocks, the air, right? I don't know anyone who loves that more than artists and creative people and scientists and engineers. the Wall Street guys could give a fuck. For the most part, I love that that part in Soul, the movie, where, you know, they're looking at the lost souls and they're like, oh, another hedge fund guy, because it was a joke. You know, maybe there's some super like materialist hedge fund guys, but the stereotype is that if you are a hedge fund person, what does that person do? They are literally all about just that money, that abstraction part of, they're just about maps. They are literally making maps and maps. They're map factories, and they've never stuck their toes on the territory. They've never ran on the territory. They've never breathed the territory, the air in the territory. They're just map people. And when you live a map life, you're going to be a quote-unquote lost soul. That's what they were trying to say. So you really got to be careful about tech reification. It happens with time. It happens with money. But it happens with a lot of shit. And we can become so ideologically possessed where we only think in terms of ideas and we can't feel reality. We can't feel the substance or process the substance. So, yeah, finances is more about the math. It's a matrix. You know, the root of the word matrix, math, matter, mother, those words are rooted from a Sanskrit word, which is Maya. And Maya has a few definitions, but it means mother of illusion. And I mean, that's what the matrix and math and matter and all those things, they're illusions. They're not stupid. People hear illusion and they think, oh, they're throw them out. They're illusions. They can't help me. No, illusions can be very helpful because they help us create reason and they help us think. But when you only see the matrix on top of whatever it is you're looking at, you know, it's like if I show you, if I say, look at the pretty sunset, looking at just the matrix would be just staring at the screen on top of the window. You know, like a window screen, and you being like, I can't, you know, like, what do you mean? And it's like, well, can you look past the net? The net is there so we can measure things. But the most beautiful parts of life cannot be measured. That's what I keep saying. That's why I said your vanity metrics can kiss my butt. That's why I said social media is a joke, because it's a huge metrics over your freaking, you know, self-esteem and confidence and person and all that. You don't got to look at that. It's just a net there to make points. You can't measure curves because they're not measurable. You have to throw a net on top and say, okay, this point, I can measure this point and this point and this point. But ultimately, it will not be a curve. It'll be lines that touch each other in the direction of a curve. But you can't really measure that curve without that net, without those lines. And when you put lines over everything and you become so blinded by lines, you can't see what's behind it. And that is what money has done to this globe. Money, like, people cannot see the wealth. Like, it's literally right here. If a billionaire has bad health and you have $5 but you have good health, who's the wealthier person? Who's the wealthier person? Oh, y'all don't want to talk about that? Oh, y'all want to be mad at people just because they have money and think that that's the answer? What do I always say? Do your eyes work? If they do, miracle. Do your ears work? If they do, miracle. Your legs work? They do, miracle. Strawberries, miracle. Wealth. Clean air, miracle. Done. Wealthy, boom. Oh, y'all want to chase billions of dollars and da-da-da-da. You're living like a billionaire wealth-wise right now if you have those things. What do they say? They say if you have a roof over your head, food in the fridge, that you're healthy, food over your... I'm gonna look it up, but it was like, if you have those like basic things, you're richer than 75% of the world who don't have those things. So people are out here feeling poor. It's so crazy. America's, I'm sorry. Like, I get it. Trust me, I think money is really dope. I'm a business person at the end of the day. Trust and believe. But I would have no joy in making money if that's all I saw. If I couldn't see past that and I couldn't see the wealth past that. Wealth is your mother smiling. Wealth is family members being alive. Wealth is, you know what I'm saying? It's bringing joy to people who you love. Just saying. So, okay. So what I wanted to talk about after that was the art world. Okay. So because the reason why I want to talk about it is because we see how much money tries, we see how much people with money try to transform it into wealth when it really doesn't have anywhere to go. What do I mean by that? I mean that when you can't use your money for survival because you already covered that, right? So you're extremely rich, you have a bunch of money piled up, you got a bunch of those shells, but you hate life, right? Because you can't understand wealth. So you're like, okay, what is it? How do I turn this money? How do I get that wealth that everyone's talking about? Well, you see it, you see people try to do this when the money doesn't have anywhere to go. When money doesn't have anywhere to go, what happens is luxury markets open and art markets open. Now, what are luxury markets? Luxury markets are markets that sell scarce products, or products made from scarce material, or products and services that are made through very high skilled level people. So, you know, like a custom car, you know, that's customized with someone actually putting their hands on it and making it customized to you. So like the higher the skill set is of the person providing the service, that's where you get the luxury market. That's when you get the furs and you get the super extravagant, crazy stuff. And I think the luxury market is one of the most fun markets to learn because you can see how people think, you can see what transaction really is on a fundamental level when you take all the seriousness out and you just see how money is used to accumulate certain resources, right? So the art market is one of the best examples. Obviously, it's a luxury market. When I talk about, I'm talking about fine arts. I'm talking about people spending millions of dollars on paintings, going to auctionings. Like you have to be a certain level to even like go to these, to get invited to an auctioning, right? And you really have to have enough money that you have nowhere else to put it, but in something like this, right? So what I love about the art market is that it's about trying to jar wealth in a bottle as much as possible, but it still doesn't really do it. But it's like the person with so much money will literally like listen to advisors about like, okay, where do I put this so I can have this, like, how can I buy wealth? That's the question. And sometimes that wealth is interpreted as actual status, like, okay, if I have this painting in my house, then I'll have this status, and that status can be a form of wealth for a lot of people. But what I see when I see a collector buying a painting for millions of dollars, I think collectors are cool. I'm not trying to shit on collectors. But what I'm saying is the artist's life and the art collector's life are so different. Because the art collector's life is filled with money and the artist's life is filled with wealth. And when I think about Basquiat, he's like probably the easiest example just because he's from Brooklyn, he's black. Like we grew up literally in the same neighborhoods. Like I just can relate, you know what I mean? And he was homeless. He was, you know, living on couches. And that was part of his way of being an artist is, you know, this is very stereotypical. It's like, oh, well, to really feel alive, I must completely surrender to just not focus on money and just focus on life. And so it's like, okay, well, how does this kid, poor kid from Brooklyn, get paintings sold to this day for millions of dollars? Like, how did, if you want to know the economics of anything, how is it not that, right? And so there's another really good book in my Amazon store called The $12 Million Shark that, you know, kind of demystifies a lot of the stuff in the economics of art. But the way I interpret this is that part of what gets brought up in the book are questions like, okay, so what gives this painting value? Is it the paint? Is it the canvas? Well, that's not the case. Is it the way it looks? Because if you paid someone else to make the same exact painting, it's not going to have the same exact value. You know, say you have a Basquiat and then you have all the tools in the world to recreate it, create a counterfeit, which does get done because that's how much people are willing to try to get that money, is they'll make a counterfeit and try to sell that, and the art world gets sabotaged with that a lot. But it's not going to be worth the same amount once an authenticator finds it and says, okay, this is fake. It's going to be always the most valuable when it is something that the artist made by themselves, you know, in their own time, in their own era. And so why is it so valuable? So what initially starts the price to go that high is that collectors, you know, high level collectors, I'm not talking about people who buy like a few paintings here and there, but like who have this as like a sport of how to use their money. The first motivator is status, 100%. It's like, okay, how do I use my money to buy status? Okay, art was one of the places, luxury market, art market, blah, blah, blah. So they buy. Okay, you know, what does it say about me if I have a Picasso in my house? You know, there's that episode, there's ATL, it's like, you got a Picasso in your house. That's the point, is like, you're trying to separate yourself from, through your class by having that. Okay, that's the first motivator. But I think beneath that, what is really happening is that the collector is trying to buy, like, they're trying to buy a time. They're trying to buy, like, a second of that artist's life. Because like I said, it's not about the paint. It's not about the value of the paint or the value of the canvas. It doesn't matter if you got the paint imported from France or Morocco or it's the most valuable pigment. Nope, because he could have been using some drugstore paint. You know what I mean? It's never about the actual physical resources. It's about this intangible value, which is his life. And what I say is that the art is, it's a fossil. You know, the art collector walks away with the money, but the artist walks away with their life. And that is what ultimately, you know, I think it brings logic to that type of pricing, because how much is an artist's life worth? You know, you think, oh my God, $17 million for a Basquiat, that's a whole bunch of money. But what is 1 second of a wealthy life worth? $17 million sounds like shit, nothing, because it is priceless. Your life, there's no price you can apply. A bajillion dollars, like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, very few people, unless they're trying to make a sacrifice for their family, would put a price on their life. You know what I mean? Like, you know, because the whole point is nothing is worth, no amount of money is worth your life, because it is this one priceless thing you have. And so for me, the art market represents the pricelessness of an artist's life and that ability to feel the wealth of the sun and the moon and the clouds and the strawberries and the peaches and the, because guess what? The art collector was over there, so focused on the money. He doesn't know he doesn't know how to feel the, you know, the grass under his toes. And I'm not saying this is for everyone, because there's some really freaking enlightened ass billionaires. There are. But we're talking generally, and we're talking culturally, right? The cultures of money-obsessed societies. That's how clueless you can be. That's how far removed you can be from wealth, is you can have all the money and still not be able to feel it. That's the difference. And so the $17 million is Trump change compared to your eyesight and your eardrums and your skin membrane feeling all the sensations of warm wind and hot tea and, you know, refreshing cool water and, you know what I mean? And so that is the difference between money and wealth. And that was why I was hoping by the end of this, you would feel wealthy. And, you know, I'm not anti-money. I'll just reinforce that. I think that should be clear. It's not about one being better or one, you know, being more important. They're both very important. And that's the point of technology. I'm trying to say is that, you know, yeah, maps are important. Territory is cool, but without maps, you don't really know where you're going. So it's the same thing with the wealth and the money. The money is just, it's this medium of currency to help trade. But we are so liable for tech reification in so many ways. And I think the other goal of this conversation was to hopefully make you less stressed out about money and make you less, if you're feeling pressure about it. You know, it's a very abstract concept. The wealth is, I'm telling you, it's the fabric. It's the quality of your mattress and your sleep. You know, I don't want to dismiss the real stress that comes with poverty. I don't want to dismiss the real stress that comes with money. But I do think that by applying this perspective, we can have a clearer focus so that if you are stressed, you can start to just, like the same thing with time, just really see it for what it is and take off the emphasis on the matrix part of it and really balance it out with what it's supposed to measure. And I noticed a few people liked my comment about how I was making fun of all the abundance people. Because, you know, we have those like, oh, abundance, the universe is abundant. And like, whatever you want, if you want 5 Ferraris, you can have it. And it's like, I don't know. I just, no, things are very finite. I think that wealth is abundant in the sense that we have enough of so much of it right now and we can't see it. But wealth is not abundant in the sense that it is not infinite. And that was my point. Money is infinite. Yeah, y'all want to talk about abundance? We have an abundance of money. We have arguably, depending on who you talk to, too much money, which is inflating the, again, the sense of what we actually have. Because if people think pants cost $50, if people think, you know, food costs $1 and... what that does is you get offended when you see the real price of things, when you see, okay, y'all say y'all want fair workers. Well, y'all, do you want to pay that price? Y'all say y'all want, you know, certain clothes at a certain price, but do you know what happens contextually? Because one of the things, too, is, like, if you don't pay the price with money, you gonna pay it with something else. This is why I love money, because I'm okay with money taking the hit if it means that my air quality doesn't have to take a hit, if it means my water quality doesn't have to take a hit. Let money take the hit. Okay, yeah, if... For example, the fashion example is so important because there was that factory that collapsed because they were being so damn cheap. But cheapness really comes at a price. Because I think, like, I gotta remember the number. I did a presentation and I mentioned it, but lots of people died because there was a cheap ass building they were using for factories to do fast fashion. And that's the thing. We think people aren't sewing our clothes. We think people aren't putting their hands on our things. One of the issues with being in the tech era is we forget people are still involved. Just because the labor is cheap and just because we have more robots doing stuff, there's still people involved. And so what is the point of paying someone a cheap amount to do a cheap job, to have cheap clothes, and poison our water or food in the process or air? Why? So you can have pants that are in fashion right now? What is the point of that? And, you know, if you live in the States, you're going to have to be, you have to buy things from the fast economy pretty much, you know, at least a little bit. You can try to focus on buying slow economic stuff. Slow economics is just what I'm talking about, where it's like, okay, to get this actual quality, you know, you got to pay what it's going to cost to make that. But, Even if you're good about that, there's areas you can't control it, like our news. Our news, where, oh well, you know, we decided as a news company we're gonna sell ads. Okay, well, what does that come at the cost of? What does that come at the cost of? Yeah, y'all have free news, but do you? Is it free? Look around. Have you paid any cost? No, you haven't paid money for this journalism, but what have you paid? Your sanity, your focus, sleep, not being able to sleep. That's what you pay. So use the money, people. Use your money. use your money, but live your wealth. Live your wealth. And remember that, next time you're at the grocery store, you're getting a better deal. And finances is cool. That's why finances is kind of silly, because what financiers do is they figure out little tricks, little places to put these pixels. So the pixel of that number grows into a bigger pixel. But it's all just math. It's all, you know, that's what they say, financial literacy. It's a different language. But wealth is the language of artists. Trust and believe. Wealth is not even just, I don't even say artists, humans. If you really want to wake up and be human today, wealth is your language. And it's here. So thank you so much for listening. Please, as always, I'm looking forward to having this conversation on Twitter, Instagram, and enjoy the rest of your day. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And if you aren't already, make sure you're subscribed to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. For more resources on innovation, economics, and culture, visit alexwolf.co/newsletter and sign up for my email list. Thanks.